Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN has started a complex operation to transfer crude oil from a decaying supertanker stranded off the coast of Yemen since 2015. The 9-day operation will pump more than 1 million barrels out of the rusting vessel, the Safer, which was abandoned over 8 years ago, to a nearby replacement vessel. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the UN has taken on the delicate operation as a spill would spell environmental catastrophe for the region.
The United Nations has begun an operation to defuse what might be the world's largest ticking time bomb. This is an all-hands-on-deck mission and the culmination of nearly 2 years of political groundwork, fundraising and project development.
Lying north of the Yemeni port Hudaydah, UN officials have warned for years about the possibility that the 47-year-old tanker could crack and explode. The UN Secretary General has called for a further $20 million to finish the project, including the scrapping of the Safer and removing any remaining environmental threats to the Red Sea. The United Nations nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, has said that anti-personnel mines have been discovered near Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, ZMPP. Rafael Mariano Grossi, the Director General of the UN agency, said that the mines were found in a buffer zone inaccessible to plant staff, situated between the inside and outside perimeter of the plant. While initial assessments indicate that the mines will not compromise the nuclear safety of the power station, they still pose a risk and add stress to the staff, said the IAEA chief. This marks the second consecutive month that the International Atomic Energy Agency has reported safety violations at the Russian-held power plant. A UN report on Tuesday warned that global temperature increases will likely have a disastrous impact on tens of millions of people in Asia-Pacific nations, the world's most disaster-prone region. According to the UN regional body ESCAP, natural disasters have killed 2 million people in the Asia-Pacific area since 1970. Under a 2-degree warming scenario, the UN body projects an increase in deaths and potential economic losses of more than $1 trillion if there is no adequate response. In a bid to find solutions, ESCAP's Committee on Disaster Risk Reductions is in talks with government officials and experts all this week. In 2022, more than 140 disasters struck the Asia-Pacific region, leaving more than 7,500 people dead and at least 64 million affected. ESCAP noted that communities living in current danger hotspots will see more frequent, intense disasters, while new risk hotspots are likely to emerge, outpacing the capacity to respond. Recommendations include greater investments in multi-hazard early warning systems to save more lives and mitigate economic impact, as studies indicate that they can reduce financial losses by up to 60%. Caitlin Kelly, UN News.
Lay your hands on the radio! Lay your hands on the radio there in the home!
It's that psychedelic time of the year. Do you know where your brain cells are?
Love Talk Radio.
You know, there's an enormous industry in this nation that is churning out day after day at the cost of billions of dollars the sensation, entirely erroneous, in the body politic that everything is okay and everything's going to keep on being just the way it is now on into the indefinite future. But of course,
Radio Free Canada
have not purchased that bill of goods.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth.
You can handle the truth!
Welcome to Radio Free Canada.
Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Dell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Canada, your one true voice in Canada, this is the Radio Free Canada.
Good afternoon, listeners, to the listening post. This is your lunchtime listening post today. Tuesday, tough Tuesday. That's when you got to get tough. You got to start your work week Monday in the blue. They call it Blue Monday. There's a history to that, by the way. Tuesday is tough Tuesday. That's how you're out there chugging. You're doing your job. You're doing it. Starting out the week. I hope you're having a good one, too. Don't let it get over on you. don't let the capitalists get over on you. Let them know. You know where we're at. You know where we're at. Boy, it's a great day. It's heating up. I got up early. I didn't get anything done outside. I planned on it. It is going to be a scorcher this week, all week, bouncing up and around 100 degrees Fahrenheit here in Jefferson County. We got a great day. We got John Grant in the second hour. It's confirmed. And he will be showing up. And we've got the latest headlines from Democracy Now! And Janine Jackson, it really is some great stuff, a counter spin from FAIR, FAIR.org. Now, that's a lot more than meets the eye there and the ear. Spins an incredible piece of work in terms of journalism. It really gets into the good stuff. And FAIR is the, well, I don't know what you call it, a sister product of it. I think FAIR originated Counterspin Magazine. FAIR pre-exists. They used to put out these little information-dense flyers, bulletins and stuff. They'd send them out. I haven't been on that list for hard copy in a long time. The website itself has all kinds of great journalists and writers. After all, it stands for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org. Can't recommend it enough to you listeners. And I, you know, as I always say, support those that support RFK. That's right. You know, I give these people a little bit of my money. Not a lot. You don't have to give them a lot. Do it monthly if you can. It keeps these institutions going. And, well, like I said, we'll have Democracy Now!, latest headlines, and Counterspin Magazine. Then we'll hopefully have a musical interlude while we round up John Grant, the infamous John Grant. And let's not forget that tomorrow, we have a full five-day schedule here, you know, folks. Tomorrow is weather on Wednesday. We'll have a lot to broadcast and talk about that there, too. And if you ever want to visit in the green room, it's area code 646-716-8652 when we're on the air, which is noon to 2, Tuesday through Saturday. You may not get on the air, but you can visit in the green room. So tomorrow, weather on Wednesday, and here's the reminder for it, a promo, and on with the news. Hit it, Tristan.
The National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the backseat, too. Made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? I'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. I've just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two, and see some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running for red light. For traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups, a limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power, the roar, the jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away, or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while. But I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A new study finds this month's record-shattering global heat wave would not have been possible without the continuing buildup of greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere due to human activity. Scientists at World Weather Attribution say a rapid analysis of weather data taken this month across China, southern Europe, and the American Southwest show high levels of carbon dioxide and other gases help drive temperatures by as much as 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. The researchers warn the past 20 days have likely been the hottest such stretch in more than 100,000 years. This comes as new research finds sea ice around Antarctica is in sharp decline and may never recover. Data from the University of Maine's Climate Change Institute show almost 2 million square kilometers less sea ice has accumulated so far during the Southern Hemisphere's winter compared to any previous year. In Sweden, climate activist Greta Thunberg was arrested Monday as she joined a nonviolent civil disobedience protest outside an oil terminal in the southern city of Malmö. Thunberg's arrest came just hours after she was fined by a Swedish court for disobeying police during a protest at the same oil terminal in June. She called her repeated protests an act of self-defense against a rapidly worsening climate catastrophe.
Right now, we don't have any laws that hold the carbon in the ground. We don't have any laws that long-term protect us against the self-destructing greed that we have let in full control over the world. The laws have to be changed. We know that we cannot save the world by playing by the rules because the rules have to be changed.
Algeria says at least 34 people have been killed and thousands more evacuated as nearly 100 wildfires burn across 16 provinces. The fires were fueled by extreme heat in North Africa, which has added to the misery of migrants attempting to cross the Mediterranean to apply for asylum in Europe. In Tunisia, asylum seekers, mostly from sub-Saharan Africa, forced to live in makeshift tent camps, are languishing under a sweltering heat wave with temperatures reaching 122 degrees Fahrenheit. Meanwhile, dozens of migrants who were rounded up by Tunisian authorities and stranded in a desolate militarized area in the Tunisian border with Libya have described harrowing conditions in the heat wave. Many have been stuck there for at least 2 weeks without any food, fresh drinking water, or shelter from the rising temperatures. This is an asylum seeker from Nigeria.
No food, no water. They materialize us here. They brutalize us. There are snakes here. Nowhere to sleep, nothing to eat. We are begging on the new end to please come to our aid. We are suffering here brutally. Look at our skin has been infected with different infection. No treatment, no food. They have been maltreating us maliciously, which is very wrong.
The Biden administration filed a lawsuit Monday against Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott over the state's installation of barrels wrapped in razor wire in the Rio Grande as an attempt to block asylum seekers from crossing the river. The suit comes after Abbott ignored a request from the Justice Department to remove the floating barrels and vowed to fight in court to keep them in place. Dozens of migrants, including children, have suffered severe injuries and lacerations after being cut by the razor wire, which is often underwater and not visible. The blistering heat wave in Texas has also been deadly for migrants crossing through the region. A whistleblower recently revealed Texas border officials were ordered to deny migrants drinking water even in the brutal heat. Israeli lawmakers have approved a highly contested bill to gut the power of the Supreme Court by preventing it from blocking government decisions it deems unreasonable. The bill is part of a broader set of judicial reforms pushed by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that have sparked months of unprecedented protests. Ahead of Monday's vote, opposition lawmakers erupted in jeers and shouts of shame before storming out of the Knesset, leaving the far-right majority led by Benjamin Netanyahu to pass the bill on a vote of 64-0. Later in the day, Netanyahu defended the legislation in a nationally televised address.
Today we carried out the required democratic move. The move was aimed at restoring a degree of balance between the authorities, which was here for 50 years.
Netanyahu had just come out of the hospital where he had a pacemaker implanted. Massive protests against the judicial reforms are continuing in Tel Aviv, where on Monday police fired water cannons, a noxious chemical known as skunk, at protesters. It's believed to be the first time Israeli police have deployed the chemical agent against Israeli citizens. Since 2008, Israel's repeatedly deployed skunk against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Meanwhile, Israel's military says it shot and killed three Palestinians in the West Bank city of Nablus. 17 Palestinians were also arrested in overnight raids. After headlines, we'll go to Israel for the latest. In Sudan, army officials Monday rejected a proposal from Kenya to send East African peacekeepers, as other regional and international mediation efforts to end the violence have also failed. Meanwhile, fighting between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces continued to escalate as the war marked 100 days on Sunday. In Russia, Kremlin officials say a Ukrainian drone attack Monday struck two buildings near the Defense Ministry's main headquarters in Moscow. This followed a Ukrainian drone attack on Saturday that hit an ammunition depot in the Russian-annexed territory of Crimea. In southern Ukraine, Russian drones struck a town on the Danube River in southern Ukraine, destroying a grain hangar. The drones struck less than 1,000 feet from Ukraine's border with Romania, a NATO member nation that the U.S. and others in the military alliance have vowed to defend. The attack suggests the Kremlin's targeting sites that provide an alternative route for Ukraine to export food and fertilizer after Russia pulled out of a deal allowing Ukraine to ship its grain across the Black Sea. This follows attacks Sunday on the Ukrainian Black Sea port city of Odessa that killed one person and injured 19 and damaged an Orthodox cathedral that's listed as a World Heritage Site. This is a survivor of the assault.
My child was enrolled here. We regularly attended the cathedral's services. The priests here are wonderful. People need to stop being so cruel.
Guatemalan police raided the offices of the Progressive Semilla Party on Friday as Semilla's presidential candidate, Bernardo Arevalo, blasted the Attorney General's office for the illegal and spurious action and political persecution, they said. Ever since placing second in June's first round of the election, the anti-corruption Semilla Party and Bernardo Arevalo have been targeted by presidential frontrunner former First Lady Sandra Torres and her allies, who are backed by Guatemala as business and political elites. The election's second round between Torres and Arevalo is scheduled for August 20th. back in the United States, a truck driver from Arkansas who was filmed assaulting a police officer during the January 6, 2021 insurrection in the Capitol, was sentenced Monday to 52 months in federal prison. Video of the incident shows Peter Steger watched as rioters attacked a police line and dragged Metropolitan Police Department officer Blake Miller into the crowd, where Steger repeatedly beat him with a flagpole. Monday's sentencing came amid signs that special counsel Jack Smith will soon announce another indictment against former President Donald Trump over Trump's role in inciting the insurrection as he attempted to remain in power following his November 2020 election loss. And President Biden's designated a national monument across three locations in Illinois and Mississippi, honoring Emmett Till and his mother, Mamie Till Mobley. On August 28, 1955, a white mob dragged Emmett Till from his great uncle's home in Money, Mississippi, and lynched him. The 14-year-old African-American boy had traveled that summer to the segregated South from his home in Chicago. Today would have been Emmett Till's 82nd birthday. Over the weekend, residents of Chicago's Bronzeville neighborhood celebrated the occasion with an ice cream social outside his childhood home. And they paid homage to Till at the Roberts Temple Church of Christ, which has just been designated a national monument. It was inside the church that Till's brutally beaten and disfigured body was displayed in an open casket at his funeral. This is Chicago resident Quintella Bounds.
I want to say it's a blessing because so often they want to erase the events that happened to African Americans. But you can't erase it if it's a landmark.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, if corporate news media didn't matter, we wouldn't talk about them. But elite, moneyed outlets do, of course, direct public attention to some issues and not to others, and suggest the possibility of some social responses, but not others. It's that context that the African American Policy Forum hopes folks will bring to their new book, based on years of research, called Say Her Name, Black Women's Stories of Police Violence and Public Silence. It's not, of course, about excluding black men and boys from public conversation about police violence, but about the value of adding black women to our understanding of that phenomenon as a way to help make our response more meaningful and impactful. If along the way we highlight that ignoring the specific intersectional meaning that policies and practices have for women who are also black, well, that would improve journalism too. We'll talk about Say Her Name with one of the key workers on that ongoing project, Kevin Manofu, Senior Research and Writing Fellow at African American Policy Forum. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. After its embarrassing town hall with Donald Trump, which helped precipitate the downfall of Chair and CEO Chris Licht, CNN has doubled down on the format, at least for Republican candidates. As Julie Holler writes for Fair.org, since Trump's May 10th appearance, the network has featured GOP candidates Nikki Haley, Mike Pence, and Chris Christie, and more are promised. Curiously, however, no offers to Democratic or third-party candidates have been announced, inviting the question, What purpose do these town halls serve? Everyone knows the non-journalistic chaotic evil that ensued from CNN's May 10th Trump rally, starting but not ending with the floor manager's instructions to the audience that while applause was permitted, booing was not. The network's ratings plunged after the fact, and CEO Licht was dropped like a suddenly hot rock. CNN anchor Anderson Cooper shook a finger at the many, many, many people mad about a nominally news outlet hosting what was essentially a Trump rally. He went on air to scold, quote, "Many of you felt CNN shouldn't have given Trump any platform to speak. Do you think staying in your silo and only listening to people you agree with is going to make that person go away?" Close quote. But Julie Holler asks, what democratic norms require offering a serial liar a town hall stuffed full of supporters in which the audience is instructed that applause is welcomed but booing is forbidden? In what way exactly does that serve the public interest? In reality land, where one hopes reporters would live, you would be hard-pressed to find a living soul who doesn't know exactly who Trump is and who his supporters are and how they can be expected to behave. That the town hall was devoid of thoughtful policy discussions, but chock-a-block with insults and falsehoods, surprised no one. Well, some of Trump's Republican challengers have broken with him to some extent, though few are risking alienating his followers by forcefully denouncing his lies. Still, CNN's own fact checks of his subsequent GOP town halls showed that Haley, Pence, and Christie were also permitted numerous falsehoods without real-time challenge by their journalist hosts. Haley, for instance, claimed that crime is at all-time highs. That's false. That Roe versus Wade made abortion anytime, anywhere, for any reason, the law of the land. That's not even close to true, according to CNN's own fact checks, and that the U.S. is very good when it comes to emissions, while the Chinese and Indians are the problem. That's seriously misleading, as the U.S. is second to China in total current emissions, with India well in third place, and the U.S. has much higher total historical emissions, much higher per capita emissions than China or India. But Jake Tapper, the host, didn't push back against any of those claims. Or look at Mike Pence's town hall, in which he announced that inflation is at a 40-year high. Well, no, that's not true. The inflation rate has actually fallen for 10 straight months. He said the Trump-Pence family separations at the border began under Obama, and Trump and Pence simply continued them. That's also false. And that the Trump administration reduced CO2 emissions beyond what the previous administration had committed to just through American innovation, through expanding American energy and natural gas. Well, CNN didn't actually fact check that one, but it's obviously and overtly false. But host Dana Bash didn't challenge any of those statements either. Lest you think it's kind of all-purpose laziness, Julie Holler points out that CNN has announced no plans to give any Democratic or independent candidates town halls. In that case, they somehow find some principles. For instance, CNN's Jake Tapper has declared that on principle he'd never be part of a town hall with Robert Kennedy because Kennedy spreads dangerous misinformation, which absolutely he certainly does. But if the concept doesn't apply to Donald Trump, how is that a principle and not just a preference? The public does need to understand the candidates they'll be choosing from next year, which means news outlets have to offer them a platform. But the kind of platform offered is crucial. In the Trump era, town halls just don't offer the tools necessary to hold politicians accountable, whether those politicians are Trump or Kennedy or DeSantis or Biden. Good journalism demands direct encounters with politicians, with incisive, probing questions that speak to people's actual needs and concerns, and real-time fact-checking, or if it's TV, maybe a taped format with fact-checking provided prior to airing. If presidential candidates or political candidates of any stripe can't agree to a platform that can hold them accountable, well, then maybe they don't deserve to have a media platform at all. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Like most powerful exercises, it's a simple one. Professor and legal scholar Kimberly Crenshaw asks audience members to stand as she lists names of black people killed by law enforcement in this country, and to sit when they hear a name that they don't recognize. For Eric Garner, George Floyd, Michael Brown, most of the crowd, whatever crowd it is, students, academics, the general public, stay standing. But when it gets to Sandra Bland, Atiana Jefferson, it thins and thins. And by the time it gets to Rakia Boyd and Michelle Cousseau, generally everyone is seated. Is that because black women's deaths via the same state-sanctioned violence that kills black boys and men are less compelling? Are the victims less worthy, or do they somehow not matter? It's hard to tease out and to talk about what's happening, but if we genuinely want to address racist police violence and bring all of us into the imagined future, we have to have the conversation. The Say Her Name Project from the African American Policy Forum, on whose board I serve, has worked to lift up the names of women, trans women, and girls killed by law enforcement on and off duty, and to talk about how their murders are the same as and different from police murders of black men and boys. That project is now reflected in a book, Say Her Name, Black Women's Stories of Police Violence and Public Silence, out this week from Haymarket Books. Joining us now is Kevin Manofu, senior researcher and writing fellow at the African American Policy Forum. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Kevin Manofu.
Hi, Janine. It's a pleasure to be on. I'm very, very grateful for you making the time. And great to be on the show.
Absolutely. Well, as you and I both know, the Say Her Name Project encompasses activism, art, research, and writing, and support for families, you know. But the heart of it, the radiating center, is still this really simple thing. Say her name. Why is that so meaningful?
I think in describing that, it's kind of useful to go back to the origins of the movement, because people are always interested in how it developed. People have probably heard about it, but oftentimes may be confused about its history. And so Say Her Name developed in around December 2014 during the protests that were ignited in New York City after the acquittal of the police officer who had killed Eric Garner. At the march, where thousands of protesters from across the country of all ages and all races joined together and were standing up against police violence, against black people, and mentioning the names of men who had been killed by police violence. In the context of that protest, the African American Policy Forum went at the protest trying to uplift the names of women who had been killed by police violence. And so in the process of being in part of that activity, we were saying the names of these women, saying their names out loud, and looking at the looks of a lack of recognition, of confusion from the other participants at this protest. And I think that was emblematic of the erasure of these stories and the ways in which, by saying the names of these women, we were speaking to them into existence in people's minds, into people's memories, and making them understand a problem that up until then they hadn't been able to see.
There's a thing that we talk about, the loss of the loss, which is, you know, there's a horror that happens, obviously, when somebody is killed by police and where you understand that it's emblematic of the worthlessness of black lives in terms of law enforcement in this country. But when it's a black woman or a trans woman or a girl and then it doesn't get acknowledged, there's like a deeper level of loss there, right? And that's kind of what this project is about.
Exactly. So as the voice described it, you know, there's the immense loss of what it means for a person to lose a daughter, a mother, a sister, a friend in their families. These are women who all had incredibly full lives. Lots of them had children, were all loved by family members and the communities. So there's that loss that everyone who's been through, who grieves or has lost someone unexpectedly will suffer. And I think that loss is exacerbated by the fact that these are women who were killed by the same institutions that are designed to protect them. So the police officers that we entrust with the safety of our communities and in our neighborhoods and in our cities are the people who are responsible for taking away these lives. And then once we understand that loss, there's the secondary loss that the family members are burdened with, which is the loss of their loss. So their loss is not legible to people. People don't recognize that this is something which is a tragedy. People don't recognize that that's something which is a problem. People don't recognize the injustice of being killed. If you are, in the case of one of the women, Miriam Carey, who was killed while driving with her 18-month-old child by the Secret Service in front of the White House. If you're killed like India Kega, who was also driving with her son in Virginia Beach and killed in a hail of bullets. If you're killed in the context of your own home over what was outstanding traffic violation like Corinne Gaines. So an inability for the general public to see the horror of these deaths and the loss that those deaths have on the family members that survive is what we like to term the loss of the loss and why this book is such a big intervention to try and publicize and get that loss into the public's attention.
And to inform the conversation about state-sanctioned police violence against black people. But I want to say, let me just intercede early. I want us to dispense early with the idea that, say, her name is somehow an invidious project. And I think some listeners might be surprised to hear, but we know that this project has been met with the idea that if you are uplifting the names of black women and girls who have been killed by police, that somehow that means you don't think it matters that black men and boys have been killed by police, you know. But I will say, having done a lot of looking into media coverage of the issue, very early on, we absolutely saw the question of state-sanctioned police violence as a question about police killing black men and boys, and to the extent that women were in the conversation, they were mothers and wives and sisters of black men who were the victims of state violence. And so let's just address the fact that this is not about saying that black men and boys are not also.
I think that's a very vital thing to add, and thanks for making that, Janine, because the whole impetus of this campaign is understanding that our politics we need to expand the scope of our politics, not just replace the names that we include. So we're not just replacing black women and black men in the conversation, but understanding that we need to have a gender-inclusive understanding of police violence. So, of course, we know that cross-racial groups, that men are killed more often. Black men are killed more than any other race and gender group. But we do know that the disproportionate, that is the black women only represent about 10% of the female population in the United States, yet account for 1/5 of all women killed by the police. More so, research suggests that 3 out of 5 black women who are killed by police are unarmed. So there's a particular vulnerability to being a black woman that exacerbates the chance of of being in a deadly and a lethal police encounter that other women don't face, and even a lot of men don't face as well. So being able to speak about that is able to make us understand how we should be able to hold the death of George Floyd in conversation with the death of Breonna Taylor, which happened only a couple of months before George Floyd was killed. So that is the point and the impetus of our project.
Well, and also a problem that is not named, is not studied, is not addressed, and then it's easier for people to say it's not really a problem because we don't have any data on it. So part of this is just to actually just collect some numbers and to say this is happening.
Absolutely. The kind of driving mantra of our work and our broader work of the Policy Forum is that we can't fix the problem that we can't see, that we can't name. And so being able to speak about, maybe to give a bit of background, this book is building on work that we did in 2015, which was the inception of our Say Her Name report. The Say Her Name report there looked at the ways in which black women were killed. So, for example, driving while black is something that we have a context for and understanding for from looking at the history of how people commonly understand police violence. But looking at, for example, how often black women who are in a mental health crisis are killed, that expanded the scope of how we understood police violence, because not a lot of people would understand that black women are often killed by the police when they actually ask for help. So giving ourselves these frames for understanding the ways in which this problem occurs both gave us a comparison to link it back to the ways in which we commonly understand it and also expanded the scope for how we wanted to respond to the crisis.
We absolutely, there is a narrative which maybe some listeners are not privy to or don't understand, but there is a dominant narrative in which black men who are killed by police are victims of state violence, but black women who are killed, what did they do to get themselves killed? And so introducing both the mental health vector, but just there's meaning in saying that it's both the same. It's, you know, racist police violence is similar, and then there are also distinctions. And if we don't pay attention to them, then we can't address them.
I think part of that work has been there's a policy intervention that is required. Of course, there's legislation both across the country and in certain states that needs to be affected to change this. But a big part of this is also just a narrative shift. So it's how the media reports on the ways in which black women are killed or reports on the science reporting them at all. And I think the Breonna Taylor example is indicative of that. The fact that Breonna Taylor was killed in March and very little was made of the fact at the time on a national scale. And then a few months later, that's when her name joined that conversation. You know, the fact that Tanisha Anderson was killed only a few days before Tamir Rice was killed by the same police department. The ways in which the media can actually just do their job better to make sure that we have a more capacious and broader frame of police violence and are able to tell the stories of these women in a way that doesn't show deference to the narratives that emanate from police sources and, you know, show the full beauty of their lives.
So important. To come back to the book specifically, this book is not, it's not just a book. It's meant to be a tool. You know, it's not meant to just kind of sit on a shelf. And Fran Garrett, who is the mother of Michelle Cousseau, who was killed by law enforcement, she talks in the book about how things are actually different based on the work around Say Her Name and how the mental health response in her community, which happens to be Phoenix, Arizona, but now mental health wellness orders are handled differently, and it's not necessarily law enforcement that comes first to your door. So the book is a way of also encouraging action. It's not just documentation of sad things. It's about how to make things different.
Absolutely. At the heart of the book, and I would encourage all your listeners to go out and get it at a bookstore near you and online, at the heart of the book is the Say Her Name Mothers Network. The Say Her Name Mothers Network is formed not long after the inception of the Say Her Name movement, and it represents mothers, daughters, sisters, family members who have lost women to police violence. And that community has existed and has existed as a source of advocacy, a source of community. It's connected them to women across the country, from Virginia to California, from New York to Texas. It shows that there is a community out there, and through this community, and then particularly through storytelling, artivism, using art to disrupt popular narratives. We released a song with Janelle Monae, who also wrote the foreword for the book, called Say Her Name, Hear You Talk About. And that's designed to just, you know, all of these narrative interventions are the seed for what becomes policy and actually becomes change. You know, this is it's a historical project that Black people have been doing in this country since our arrival. And it's a great Black feminist legacy that brings this book into fruition.
And then just on media, I think some listeners might think, well, media are covering police violence against Black women. And what they might be thinking about is these terrible, wrenching videos, you know, or these just horrible images of Black women being abused by law enforcement. And, you know, we want to be careful about this, because I think for a lot of people that might look like witnessing, you know, that might look like seeing what's happening. But that can't be the end of the story. And certainly for journalists, the responsibility of reporters, but also for all of us, is to not just look at it, but to do something about it. And I wonder if you were talking to reporters or thinking about journalism generally, what would be just kind of your thoughts about what would be actually righteous response to what's happening?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, of course, we live in an age of spectacle, and there is still a great spectacle to Black suffering. And the visibility of that has increased with the internet and social media, has been important in being able to document abuses and violence across the country. But the story can't end there. It can't end there at just that particular moment. You know, if this was a camera shot, the camera needs to be expanded to look at the dynamics of the communities, the relationship between police forces and these communities, and the patriarchal relationship between the male police officers and women, the racialized relationship between a police force which has been designed to serve white interests and Black communities. And so to do the vital work of understanding what led to that situation, what led to the, you know, the Black girl being violently dragged out of a classroom or beaten for swimming or killed in a part of the misguided war on drugs, you know, to understand that broader story is kind of the vital work of journalism that we need at the moment, and the vital work that is actually going to save lives.
Well, do you have any final thoughts, Kevin Manofu, about this importance and the place of this intervention in the public media conversation about Say Her Name and about police violence against Black women? Any final thoughts?
I think the Say Her Name book is, as I said, it features different interviews with members of Say Her Name Network. And so just hearing those stories and actually getting behind a new story and learning about the lives that should have been is really important for everyone to be able to contextualize and humanize the women that form part of the network and this broader movement, and look at the ways in which the knowledge that is being lifted up here is vital to us understanding racism, sexism, and at the same time, while being cognizant of the fact that, like, that is the precise knowledge which, at the moment, with a backlash to what is termed wokeness across the country attempting to erase, I can imagine that the context of the Say Her Name book would inflame the sensitivities of various conservatives and right-wing people that are attempting to silence our ability to speak about our circumstances because they don't want us to change it. So in this context of that environment, reading this book, sharing it with your communities, letting people know about the problem, letting people know that to truly respond to structural racism, to racial injustice, we have to have a gender expansive, gender inclusive understanding of it. I think that's the work, that's the kind of mission of Say Her Name, and we've been very grateful to be supported by the public so far. We've seen the movement grow, but, you know, there's still so much work to be done, and that's the work that we're excited to continue.
We've been speaking with Kevin Manofu, Senior Research and Writing Fellow at the African American Policy Forum. You can learn more about this work on the website aapf.org. Thank you so much, Kevin Manofu, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Thank you.
clouds, turn up the moon, do it soon. I can't enjoy this night without you. Shake down the stars, dry up the stream, stop all my dreams. Cut up the breeze, do it please. I never thought I'd cry about you. Shake down the stars. I gave you my arms, my lips, my heart, my life, my love, my all. But the best that I had to offer you, I found was all too small. Crush every rose, hush every prayer, break every vow, do it now. I know I can't go on without you. Shake down the stars.
Said thanks for a lovely weekend. Those 2 days in heaven you helped me to spend, and the thrill of your kiss as you stepped off the train. The smile in your eyes was like sun after rain, and to mark the occasion we went out to dine. You remember the laughter, how we laughed, and the music, Harry Roy's band, and the wine, no champagne, but just wine. Then we waited a long time for a taxi, but we got one at last. And then breakfast the next morning, just we two alone. And I had to go, and the time was so short. We both had so much to say, and you packed my kit. The train had to be caught, and what a train. Then I cried. And now have you gone, dear, this letter I penned. My heart travels with you until we meet again. So keep smiling, my darling, and someday we'll spend a lifetime as sweet as that lovely weekend.
Boy, listeners, we have it. We've done it. We've pulled it off again. We've got John Grant live, and I get the leading question, as they call it, and the investigation into John Grant's brain. I think, you know, John has written for many publications, one of them including Penthouse Magazine. And he also, if you're a regular listener on Tuesdays, you will find out that, you know, he has these particular theories. I think they're basic Freudian. I'm not sure about Santos and Eros, E-R-O-S. I think that's
Eros,
what it is.
Eros and Thanatos, or more to the point, the life instinct and the death instinct. That would be what
right.
Freud was muttering about 1920 or something.
Yeah, but there's some, I mean, the word E-R-O-S is,
right.
We're talking erotica.
And, the man named Chris Hedges, who we all know, some of us respect, in his best book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, talking about his work in, Bosnia and El Salvador and things like that, he has a chapter on Freud's Eros and Thanatos that is what keyed me into the whole idea, which, granted, even in Freud's day was a little half-baked, you know. It's interesting, but, you know, talking about large human impulses that, you know.
Oh, damn, John, you're doing it today.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, that's cool. Leading question. One of the hottest true crime dramas taking place on Court TV
Okay.
And it's like a wildfire right now. It's
right.
About
wow.
a 25-year-old woman. Her name is Taylor Shaw Business, and I'm not kidding. It's
okay.
Shaw Business.
Okay.
And I couldn't help. I know, at talking like a cis male right now. I couldn't help snickering because she is certainly a component or a candidate of hashtag Me Too. She went down to this puppy dog. You can see pictures of him. His mother's basement where he lived. He had a little apartment down there in the finished basement. And he's 22. He was 22 at the time. She was 24 at the time. And she went down in the basement. And maybe I haven't done my research enough, but she was down there having sex and doing drugs with his last name is Syrian. And it was turned into what her defense lawyer is calling rough sex. Well, you know, she ended up cutting this guy's head off and his penis and sticking it in a bucket. This is really a super gross type murder. I mean, chopped him up. This is all in his mother's basement. Okay.
Oh my God! Where did this happen?
Of all places, Wisconsin. Once again, I'm pretty sure it's
the dairy state. Okay.
It's a flyover country there too. I mean, a lot of people fly over it. Like
and what became of her? Was she caught by the long arm of the law, or what?
Well, the victim, the guy's mother, called the police and. The 911 call is public information, and you can hear. And I wonder if she has a problem too, because she wasn't screaming or anything when she called the police. They said, "Well, how do you know he's dead?" She says, "Well, his head is in a bucket downstairs."
That's a telltale sign. Yeah.
More or less matter of fact, you know.
Wow.
And all this latent rage in our society I watched the hearings that she's heard the trial on Sports TV this morning, and I thought of you and I, especially you, John Grant,
why would that make you think of me? Okay, go ahead.
Because we've talked about
I'm game. Go.
We've talked about the identitarian movement in the left wing and the right wing today, and over the years, and it's like this is such a grotesque crime. There's one of many. I mean, we have 325 million people, so this is just
right.
But
of course,
this is one of the most high profile that I could speak as a guy.
Well, because it's so sensational and grotesque and bizarre, you know.
Now that's a good way.
Women are, you know, supposed to be sweet and all this stuff, and you know, now we have all the, you know, the pink of the Barbie doll movie, Barbie movie, you know.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, 150.
Feminist propaganda with the pink Barbie doll. So how does this is the this is like the dark side, I suppose. Now this woman lured a man down in the basement?
I think they were an item, as they say out here in the country. They were sort of together, and she. I mean, why would mom let her down there? The dominatrix, S&M. I mean, down there, and they were doing methamphetamine, and that's her defense, and she is crazy. There's a lot of clips, infamous clip of her attacking her defense attorney during, I think it was the arraignment, and she attacked her own attorney, and they had to, I think Wisconsin's where the state's been. They have two parts. Obviously, she conspired. I mean, she chopped the guy's body up and got it out of the house, except for the bucket with the head and his penis in the bucket. And part one, of course, definitely premeditated murder, but part two in this particular state is is she crazy or not? And the court has ruled that she's competent to stand trial. But it's, I mean, she reminds me of sort of Charlie Manson, but Charlie never really killed anybody. He got other people to kill people for him.
Well, yeah, Charlie was about control. He was, you know, about like Jim Jones. He was a cult control freak, you know, and he liked to control his girls. And, you know, they just let one of them out like 2 weeks ago, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I was for that. I mean, 40 years. Control. Well, she used a. Now the court has it wrong. They call it a dog collar, and court TV has it wrong. It's not a dog collar. It's called a choke chain that is used by dog trainers to train dogs. It's a tough way of training a dog, but you can train them with a choke chain. And she used a choke chain on this guy to kill him. And then, of course, she used there was like 11 sex toys. They call it sex toys. She used one of the
Let's back up here a minute.
I just wonder
why, what this means, you know. I mean, sure, the humans are capable of anything. It's like, you know, I can imagine somebody, you know, grinding people up in a meat grinder and eating them. You know, God, you can think of horrible, horrible, horrible things that humans are capable of.
Right.
There's this guy now in Long Island, you know, there's always a story every day now about guy who picked up prostitutes and killed them and left them out in the swamp in the, you know, the brackish water around Long Island. And
I don't know what you do with that stuff.
You know, there's that kind of murder, and then there's the kind of violence that is now political that we're dealing with, and I guess they can get mixed up. You know, we have random violence, and does that have something to do with the current politics of our time? We live in a very, very bizarre time, and what that means, you know, this gruesome murder, I don't know.
Right. Well, the question for me is, and statistically, is it episodic, incidental, or is it a barometer that tells you?
Well, this is what, you know, Sigmund Freud, the old whack job Sigmund, you know, who had a cocaine habit. He was a human being and all this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and he always, you know, he couched a lot of things that everybody wanted to have sex with their mother and all that. And then there was a period, well, we're not sure that really had a bearing. He was just talking about himself and projecting it out to everybody else. But still, I mean, the guy was very, very interesting, and he was concerned. He communicated with Einstein for years in letters. Trying to figure out why human beings seem to be on a road to hell, a runaway train to Second World War, you know, after the first one. It's like, why are we on this runaway train? Well, what is it about human beings that they seem to want to secretly destroy themselves, you know, by doing stupid things and having stupid wars and all this kind of stuff? And, you know, as I say, it was all half-baked a little bit, you know, and he and Einstein were worried about this. Obviously, they didn't solve the problem because we had World War II. You know, and the Cold War and everything, the human beings, you know, seem to have this on some level, arguably some kind of impulse to do stupid things and end up, you know, destroying your culture or something. You know, look at the impulse of Adolf Hitler. I mean, he destroyed Germany. He just absolutely ran into the ground and destroyed it. Having this crazy, Freud would say, thanatotic impulse to destroy and kill a certain kind of people that he didn't like, you know. And it's like, well, it ended up biting him in the ass, and, you know, Germany was taken to the ground and beaten and crushed. And, of course, what they learned was, do not do what they did at the end of World War One. Was, you know, I'm reading this book now called by Fred Ickley. It's called All Wars Must End. And so the point is, all wars must end. So let's not forget that all wars must end. And while we're going on with our wars, these stupid wars and whatnot,
right.
let's have a team that's thinking about how the hell are we going to end the goddamn thing, you know, in some way, which, frankly, John Kerry's doing in China right as we speak. And and so, you know, that sort of plays into this whole Freudian idea. In other words, why, when the wars start, you know, does, as Frederick Clay would say, we get into this escalation dominance, he called it, or dominance escalation. In other words, once you go, things aren't going well, you escalate and you kill more people. You know, the Russians are now frustrated in Ukraine. They're starting to destroy the food supply in Ukraine, you know, the warehouses of wheat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's like it just escalates, this escalation of violence and killing and destruction, and it becomes a, you know, sort of a runaway train. You know, wars are easy to start and hard, very hard to stop. And so Fred Ickley would say, well, that is a bit of wisdom that human beings have learned over the eons. So why don't we pay attention to that? And, okay, why we have a team that's blowing shit up, why don't we have another team that's trying to figure out how not to blow shit up and figure out a better way that everybody gets together? Because, as he says in his title, all wars must end at some point.
Yeah.
In the 30 years of the 100 years wars, they ended, you know. And we, you know, we don't do that. We don't do that officially. You know, we have a peace movement, and, well, peace movement is crushed at every opportunity. You know, you have people like Robert Oppenheimer, who's now big fashion in the nation with his Oppenheimer movie.
Yeah.
And I saw a documentary about him the other day, and he was a guy who wanted the bomb. He's the smartest guy, but he was one of these guys that crossed over with science and art and spirituality. He was a very, very complicated and interesting fellow. He wasn't a war horse. He wasn't a murderous bastard that just wanted to kill people. But still, he felt that this bomb had to be built, and he was going to build it, and he advocated dropping it on the Japanese the way they did.
Yeah,
because he said, yeah, we'll kill millions of people, thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, but we got to do this, and this will stop all wars in the future. Well, he was wrong, dead wrong. And soon after he dropped the bomb, you know, the first time that bomb went off, they didn't even know if it was going to trigger, if it was going to work, and it would work because it had like 10,000 connections and things. And they were, Oppenheimer amongst them, were just stunned, according to the documentary, floored, like, of the destruction of this thing that they had, I mean, they knew nothing about it. It was much, much more devastating and destructible, I guess, than they could ever imagine, right? And then they dropped it. And then over, you know, time, and by, you know, by the time Truman's now in, he just made a decision. Oppenheimer comes to like a meeting in the Oval Office with Harry Truman, and Harry Truman is concerned about the Russians getting the bomb. How do we prevent the Russians from getting this goddamn bomb? And frankly, it sounds to me like all Oppenheimer wanted to talk about was, you know, questions about the bomb, because he apparently cupped his hands to Truman and he said, "I have blood on my hands." This really pissed Truman off.
Yeah,
and
sure
basically,
does.
Truman got impatient and threw him out of the fucking office and told his aides, "I never want to see this man, that man again. You know,
well,
get that fucker. He's bad luck. He's, you know, get him out of here." You know what I mean? This weak sister stuff about, "Oh, I don't like killing so many people." You know, get the fuck out of my sight. Well,
Truman,
maybe they should have listened to the man. Like, maybe there's a better way. And to just, instead, what do? We got to make sure the Russians don't get it, because we know our impulse is we're going to blow each other up and, you know, have this standoff. And then, of course, we're right to Dave Lindor's movie here, a Compassionate Spy, where, you know, they're worried about Oppenheimer being a security risk, right? The guy who runs the goddamn program. And meanwhile, it's some fucking teenager brilliant teenager who gives the stuff to the Russians, you know, and gets away with it for 50 years.
Well, I was,
you know, they're not working on all cylinders here in a cultural system, as Fred Ickley would say. You know, they're not figuring like, holy shit, the potential for this is outrageous. Anyway, so that's my spin on it. It is wrapped up in this half-baked Freudian idea, you know, that it's in there. It pops up. It's in there somewhere, you know. But getting, you know, it's like picking up mercury on the floor trying to figure out something like, you know, a death instinct in humanity and humankind. It's just such a large and an untenable idea that it's like poetry, you know. It's like becomes like art and poetry, and you know, Oppenheimer apparently cited and quoted the Ramadan or one of the Indian talk about I am death and I am destruction and all this kind of stuff.
The Bhagavad Gita, I think, is the name of it. The Hindu.
And so a complete misfit between the complexity and sensitivity of an Oppenheimer and, you know, the hardcore World War One stubborn Missouri vet, you know, that Harry Truman, who, you know, didn't, you know, FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, was all ready to, he talked about, you know, giving the European colonized, you know, developing world, giving them their independence. When the Vietnamese asked us kindly, because they'd been our ally in World War II, hey, would you guys, you know, advocate with the French to get the fuck out of our country? You know, because, you know, they cowardly hid in their barracks when the Japanese came. And, of course, the Ho Chi Minh and his Viet Minh fought with the OSS, the predecessor CIA, as guerrillas against the Japanese. They were our ally. And then Truman betrays them.
Betrayal,
you know, because he wants to fucking kill everybody. That's why, you know.
Well, this is more.
You know, you don't want to talk to anybody here, respect anybody, respect someone like Ho Chi Minh. No. He's a gook. He's a compi. You know, kill him. You know, get him out of here. And you know that lockstep mind, based on, you know, imperial power. We were the top dog in World War II. Everybody was a wreck except us. You know, World War II empowered the United States incredibly as it devastated everybody else. And so we wanted to keep that dominance in the world. And you know, I'm sort of going off a little bit here. So.
No, I wanted to ask you that because it's such a grotesque form of violence. It's the modern day equivalent of Elizabeth Borden. It's a grotesque murder, and it's captured the attention of many millions of people. And I was snickering,
absolutely,
thinking, well, is this a spinoff of Me Too? No, I think you're right about the essential thrust of history. But
well, I just think
also,
it's the quirks, the really, really dark evil, let's use that word, quirks of human beings, humanity.
Well,
that we know over time, the Inquisition, these horror moments in life where, you know, I mean, look at Hussein, Saddam Hussein's torturers in Abu Ghraib, you know, using electric drills on people and things. I mean, the most horrendous stuff you can imagine.
Right.
But, these dictators, they get in these positions and they accept that, you know, going off on the side in Abu Ghraib. You know, I've been to the parking lot of the place. It was a huge thing. And, heinous things are going on. This is part of certain types of political situations. And, we want to avoid that in the United States. We don't want this top-down sort of, can you imagine giving power to a Donald Trump and then appointing Michael Flynn to, you know, run the military or something? I mean, it's just the most frightening idea I could imagine, you know, somebody like Michael Flynn, who's, you know, capable of the worst. Anyway, I'm sort of blathering here, sorry.
No, I, in many of these these cases when it comes to this kind of extra parliamentarianism. I always opt and say it's better to have some sort of gardener, a caretaker,
right,
as the government,
yeah,
rather than an aggressive seeking power between contentious factions within.
Well, I think the gardening image is a very apropos image.
I really believe that. I believe that.
I'm with you. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
A friend of mine who works at the VA had a dissertation in which she said it's all about gardening. You get these whacked out vets who, you know, have post-traumatic stress and have done things that are horrible things, and it's just,
right,
it doesn't fit right with them, and it gnaws at them, and, you know, they drive too fast, and they head on collisions and drunk and God knows what else, drug dumb their heads. And she says, well, one thing that really works is gardening. You know, look at this tomato plant. Look how it pops out of the ground. Look how it wants to grow, and look what
it makes.
And this process of, this is Eros. This is the life-giving process, you know, watching it and being part of it and nurturing it, husbanding it, to use a husbandry idea in gardening. And of course, it works. The woman's husband, a friend of mine, I did a film on him in Vietnam, and, you know, he's a gardener, incredible gardener. Gardening has really, you know, this whack job is straightened himself out with gardening. You know, my father abandoned a good life in New York and went to a shack in South Dade County, almost on the Keys, so that he could run around in his ratty shorts and shoes and grow things. That's what he wanted to do. You know, he just wanted to be eccentric, and he did. He incredible. I mean, not even a gardener. He was like an amateur nurseryman and, you know, botanist. And this is what was important to him, and it made him sane. I mean, didn't prevent some of his bigotry, but, you know, it made him more sane anyway.
Yeah, right, at the time, at that point of history.
At the time, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have the duality of being close to someone who's been trained in the medical establishment.
Right.
And I brought this thing up about Freud years and years ago when we first were together, and she was trying, she explained to me and steered me to some, but for the first time I read some Freud at that time, and I was like, and she pointed out, she said, well, the problem is that it's all about time, and therapy, psychotherapy takes a lot of time. You have to, it's usually a one-on-one thing, and it's time-consuming. Many people cannot afford it. If you're going to be a professional psychiatrist who can prescribe medicine, you have to, that's what she recommended. And there's a lot of knockoffs now in the 21st century. Late 20th century when her and I were talking about this. And she said they're licensing psychologists, people who are not really trained in any anatomical medicine, you know, on cause and function. They seem to be more on psychology. And she explained to me the difference. But she said, so psychotherapy takes a lot of time and money, and people will not do that because it's like a gardening thing. You know,
it's
kind of
like an elitist indulgence, if you will.
That's how it's perceived. But she was of the opinion.
But it's based on the basic idea of the Greeks, know thyself. And so the
idea
is peel the onion back and who the fuck are you?
Right.
You know?
And it helps to have someone holding a ruling stick, not a stick, but to help you gauge whether you're making progress, you know, or not. And it takes time.
But then things got complicated.
It's all right. Let me just finish. I'm glad I'm sparking your – I'm getting you to fire on all cylinders, as they say. But she also explained that the real push was not – it was not psychotherapy for all. She said that, as you implied, it's an elitist thing. She said it would be best if there were – psychotherapy available for all versus
the other
school of psychiatry within psychiatry. That the psychiatry, in her opinion, that undermined and eventually proved that Freud was wrong. But they also
right.
did it in a devastating way.
Mm-hmm.
And she pointed out a landmark building on top of the biggest hill in Topeka, Kansas, that it's called the Menninger Institute. And
oh,
the Menningers
right.
were notoriously anti-nuclear war and very
right.
smart.
Was it Carl
doctor.
Menninger, I think, wrote books
yes,
and things?
Very good, very good. Yes, world famous, yeah, on child,
yeah.
on raising kids, all kinds of things.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
they were centered on psychotherapy and that kind of work, you know. It
mm-hmm.
was very famous. But even this, they got ran out of Kansas. Menninger
right.
left in disgust about 30 years ago. They shut
uh-huh.
the whole, and it was a gigantic facility. I mean, it had its own hospitals, its own power. It's still there,
mm-hmm.
the buildings, but they're all empty. But
mm-hmm.
her point was, she said,
mm-hmm.
now it's easier to just issue drugs like Stelazine
exactly.
and Thorazine and give
right.
them pills and then less and less psychotherapy and more.
Exactly.
Chemical lobotomies is what the word came out
right.
of.
Right. Well, you had the introduction of, I guess, what, the 50s, behaviorism, you know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
the
mm-hmm.
idea of instead of delving and peeling the onions back and asking you what's going on in your life and asking you about narratives and dreams and things like that,
right,
to try
right.
to accumulate an idea of who the fuck you are, pardon the expression. And I don't
right.
think it's not a permanent thing, this idea that everyone has a permanent absolute identity is garbage.
Right.
We are in completely fluid creatures, you know. We decide what our identity is. In other words, if we're Jewish, we decide that's what I'm hanging my hat on. I'm a Jew, you know. Or if I'm a homosexual, well, because
right.
it's such a hard life, that's what I am, you know. And you know, this is our identitarian, I use that word, identity politics these days. This is what we're about. But the point is, that's because this whole idea of psychoanalysis is trying to understand what you are instead of as a noun and a permanent identity, as a verb. You're an action figure. You know, you make decisions every day, and you become a different person with every decision. It's very, very, very complicated when you think of it that way. And that's where, you know, psychoanalysis comes from. But nowadays, with so many people, especially with the Internet, psychoanalysis, as I say, is an indulgence. And, you know, it's much, much more difficult because we don't have the time to do that. As you said, it takes great time. So instead, we focus on our behaviors. Well, let's stop that by, here, take this drug. Well, if that doesn't work, try this. Maybe we'll double the dose, you know. And my wife went through this with the, you know, the Zoloft and all those depression drugs and different.
Well, there's also an additional danger that she pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't say it's a danger. It's actually, those are like billy clubs, Thorazine, Stelazine.
Yeah, they're heavy duty. Yeah.
The heavy duty stuff. But and this is updated. We were studying this, and she pointed out that this new, I don't know her word, but it's something like it's a new school of psychopharmaceutical drugs now are actually getting where they're adjusting the brain chemistry. They're they're able to do it without the bluntness and the crude method
right.
of just drugging people where they can go to work and go home and that's all they do.
Right.
That's all they can. They can actually adjust it where they're fine tuning it. And it's still there's a whole new school, a generation of
well, they're getting realistic.
Psychopharmaceuticals.
They're advocating, you know, medical marijuana for one thing, and
right.
Or what's the social drug? What do they call it? You know, where everybody gets social and you know you
MDMA. I'm not
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, they'll want to know that. And they're using that for PTSD, you know. And they're very logical, you know. I mean, I remember the story on medical marijuana, which, you know, I did a piece that's in a textbook on medical marijuana. And this guy had been he was a whacked out vet, basically. And, you know, they had him in a cocktail of, like, you know, 8 different drugs that he was taking. He couldn't, you know, and he was a zombie. And he lived in some urban situation. So what he did was he moved to some more out-of-the-way place, rural place. He got rid of all his drugs and started smoking weed. And he was fine. You know, it was like he didn't have all the complications that he had in his social life, and he made his life simpler. And he didn't have all these, you know, these crude things you were suggesting that, you know, that are working around and turned him into a zombie.
Right.
And so, you know, what do you make of that? That whole cycle of drugging people, you know, they used to give them lobotomies, of course. You know, they scoop out the front of your brain where your personality exists, you know. And, you know, one of the Kennedy sisters had her frontal lobe scooped out, you know, back in the day. There was, of course, the Eagleton, you know, where they jack you up with electricity. Because, you know, Thomas Eagleton, I think that was his name, the vice president.
From Missouri.
He had run for Senate, and he had, like, postpartum depression sort of thing. He, you know, once he'd won the seat, he just collapsed because now what? You know, I had all this bullshit campaigning. Now I got to govern, and I don't know what the fuck to do, you know? And so he went off, and they electrocharged his brain to get him lined up again. And, of course, once that came out, nobody wanted him as vice president.
That's right, vice president.
If you see that Robert Redford movie, good, I saw it the other day, called in the 70s, The Candidate. He's running for, son of Melvin Douglas, a big capital, you know, big politician, famous politician. And he's the young guy in California. He's run for Senate, you know, he's amateur at this. In the 70s, and, you know, what's his name? Boyle, the actor Boyle, is his political activist. Peter Boyle is great, and by the end of it, they do, and he wins, and Redford, they're all exciting, you know, everybody wants to kiss him and drinks, you know, and he says, wait a minute, Peter, he said to Peter, come here, I gotta talk to you, and he gets him into the room, and he says, what the fuck are we going to do now? And it's exactly the Eagleton thing, you know, it's like, oh my God. I'm a senator. What the hell am I supposed to do? It's like going from junior high, where you're ninth grade, you're the top dog, and suddenly you're in high school and you're nothing. You're dog shit. You're a freshman, and you know, suddenly now he's a senator. It's like, oh my God, I'm in the Senate with all these predatory other senators. They've been here for 30 years. You know, they're gonna kill me. And you know, these are psychological states, I suppose.
Well, and we must keep in mind, since we're sliding into cinema. You brought it up. You know, Barbie the movie. Barbie the movie.
Oh, Barbie.
Greg Ken, are you ready for this, listeners? Barbie. $155 million in one 48-hour period in box office tickets. That's Barbie.
And they're touting this thing with Oppenheimer and Barbie, this battle, that both these movies are original. I heard that today.
What?
I heard it somewhere else.
Original.
This isn't the Superman IV or something, you know, or Batman 16 or Rambo 12, you know, these are original movies. It's like, wow, America has actually accomplished something by big blockbusters that are actually completely original, you know, it's like, you know, they're not the safe bet because the other 12 versions of this stupid story, made tons and tons of money, so we got to make another one. You know? And, you know, these people went out on a limb and made something original, you know. Now, that said, I think Oppenheimer is probably going to be an incredible, successful movie, because I think it's perfect.
You think so?
Oh, I think its timing is perfect. Perfect.
Yeah, I think it's certainly more relevant to the times we live in than Barbie. Yeah.
Barbie, I think, is probably...
Why would you take
I don't think Barbie's helping anybody out, you know. I think Barbie...
Why would you
just
take your daughter to Barbie? I'm trying to figure
out. I don't know. Barbie used to be a sign of oppression to me for women, you know, on the pedestal and all this. Well, now being on the pedestal is what? A feminist... skill or a feminist quality of power?
It's beyond me.
I don't know. You know, it's a very interesting question of what Barbie means. I don't know, you know.
Well, plus you've got the problem of distribution. I mean, at least for here, Dave Lindorf's movie, A Compassionate Spy, well, it's not his movie, but he co-produced it.
Co-produced it, sure.
Yeah, and he's got a book out.
He's done a lot.
For No Country. It's not out. Listeners, it won't be out till October is the last I heard. But the movie, the book is based on, is appearing in Oklahoma. That's as close as it gets here. And if Dave wanted to come on air and announce that it's coming on in Oklahoma, I'll hopefully get the specifics before it flies through the flyover zone.
Yeah, well, he's having a showing here in Philly we're going to go. So I've seen it already. Once we're going to go see it again.
Well, good for you. And Oppenheimer, the movie, which you think is going to compete with Barbie, it is here and gone, and it's coming back. But it's like you have to pay $6 to book a place, and the theater is 28 miles away.
What do you mean, an IMAX theater?
No. I understand it's supposed to be even better on IMAX. Yeah, nearest IMAX is 70 miles away at least. And
yeah, I am not interested to see it in IMAX. I want to see it in the format where I watch most movies. I don't want to be overwhelmed with the technology of the movie. I want to see the story. And it's located here, I believe, in a couple of theaters. A friend of mine has seen it. Right?
Yeah, you've got the, that's a luxury out here, even in the city. Oppenheimer is...
Well, the politics of Kansas may mitigate against it being shown around.
I think theater owners may be, you know, they make the decision, I think. I don't know, but we went to go see this and we found out that the theater wasn't open. So it's like, it's going to take another three or four days before they open the doors, because theater, you know, post-COVID, I think they're probably having a hard time keeping their damn places open to even have big screen movies. But Oppenheimer is definitely a contender out here in terms of people wanting to see it. It's just that will it be here long enough for people to get to it? It's not like the oldest. I was laughing to my sweetheart when she was trying to book the tickets, and she found out, well, we got to pay $6 to book the tickets, and you got to have tickets to get in, and you can't. Mm. It's not like you can walk in the old days. It's not like the old days, but you can just walk up, and the theater is playing 24 hours, 7 days a week, you know, with newsreels. Mm. You know, I was like, nope, like that anymore at all. It's a reserve event.
It gets so confusing for me where the hell things are streaming. I don't even know anymore. It's like, finding these movies is, there's so many movies made. I mean, look at Netflix. It's like you're overwhelmed with all these movies.
Oh, yeah, right. And now they have the international films that are part of it. At least, and, it's sort of I noticed they're more dense with plot and story. But they're not nearly as, cutting your boyfriend's head and penis off and putting it in a bucket. It's not European.
Leave it to
the Americans. But it's been a very interesting thing watching the post-COVID. The inflation's gone down, as if you listened in the first hour, listeners. Janine Jackson at Counterspin reliably cited that the lies that people like Mike Pence and Trump and others and some Democrats are saying about inflation, it's actually has been going down the last 10 months post-COVID. Right. And it's sort of interesting to see people refute, and I think that's part of the job that we do here at on our Tuesdays with This Can't
Right.
Be Happening.
We accomplish anything. Maybe we plant a seed here and there. Who knows?
I really think we should bust these myths, among people. I think that's a good thing, a service that we should provide to the listening public out here, especially in Kansas. We need it. Interesting things happening here. I'll spare that for later, but basically there are well-educated people in the countryside who are in Jefferson County, where I live, who are successfully shutting down all kinds of intrusive businesses that are polluting and screwing up the potential to screw up the rural area.
Right.
There's two notorious companies tried to make a gigantic server for cryptocurrency, and the servers are required. It takes like these huge diesel engines running on natural gas, and they had a supply of unlimited natural gas at this one property, and they were going to use that to run these diesel compressors to run the servers to gamble cryptocurrency and sell cryptocurrency. They shut that one down. The people did. They complained to the county committee. It was democracy, really. And then the most recent one was a food waste plant, which recycles or does something. It makes biofuel out of rotten garbage. And it's a
right. I've heard of that. Yeah, fermenting.
And it's sort of a green company, but in a way, it's not, because the trucks, the massive truck traffic, to haul the waste into on gravel roads, destroy the roads, and it's going to be like a massive landfill in this East Jefferson County's backyard, and it's going to have this stink, and they haven't shut it down, but they're making them go by the rules, so you can see that. I see these things happening, and I think, wow, people are, in their own way, they're rebelling against this crazy.
Well, my limited experience with Kansas is always dealing with you on this radio show. That it seems to me, in a place like Kansas, I mean, all kinds of, let's use the word, progressive ideas.
Right.
Are generating, are bubbling up here and there in these places that aren't necessarily friendly to that stuff. But it's still, I mean, the bubbling up goes on, it's all happening.
Right. You could pick any, here's the contradictory. And yet the county commissioners, the same ones that everybody goes through in the county, they have put a moratorium on, for 1 year, on all solar and wind electric generation projects in the county.
Really? Why would they do that?
Well, this is the thing in Kansas. This is the contradictory nuttiness of Kansas, because it's like the county commissioners, three out of three were outright, I'm sure, Trump supporters.
Wow.
Our newspapers, we only have two. Reporters don't push them against the wall on that, because
seems to be an overcompensating backlash of, it's just, in other words, the backlash is so outrageously desperate that it becomes oppressive. I mean, there's no other word for it. But that doesn't prevent the ideas from being there, and so they have to bubble up in their own way and find their own channels to the surface, or whatever metaphor you want to use, but this stuff bubbling up.
But I think the county commissioners feel the heat from these decisions they make arbitrarily versus the people coming to them with this. Hey, what about these, you know, millionaires right. coming in to try to take over yeah. and affect the environment and
of course
screw up
capitalism,
the,
profit, yeah, market.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, who are these people come from? I mean, you know, and the county commissioners are feeling that heat, and I think they're no matter if they're scared to say, yeah, I support Trump, or I didn't
right.
support Trump, or yeah. autocracy, dictator.
Exactly. Well, that's the issue.
They're afraid to say either way on that. That's why they never get asked about it. But
well, you know, excuse me. The Israel situation. Israel now is a microcosm
yeah,
of all this.
Yeah, do
it's
that.
Very
yeah, do
interesting.
It.
The idea that people in the streets and you know, reservists are so critical to the security of Israel, and these pilots saying, "I'm not flying for you anymore if this is what you're going to do," and you know, thousands and thousands of people in the streets. And yet they did it yesterday. They, you know, they put this law through that, you know, they have no constitution over there like we have here. And,
well, that protest movement is, and by the way, I want to jump in. That's
yeah.
been going on for over a month, 2 months. It's
absolutely.
Been going on and on and on, a massive scale. What is
right,
it?
Right.
We only got a few minutes. What is it all about, John Grant?
It's all about, again, the country has no constitution. It has one legislative body, not two like here. And it has a Supreme Court that, unlike ours, which is far, far right, their Supreme Court remains pretty liberal. And their Supreme Court has the capacity, you know, in their legalisms and all that, and their traditions, to have the power to say a law or some function of the legislature or the premier, prime minister, is, quote, unreasonable. This is the key word, reasonableness. In other words, the Supreme Court had said, look, this, you know, this is an autocratic thing. We're a democracy. So what you're doing here, this law, is unreasonable, and we're going to nix it. You can't do it. Well, so what that meant is the legislature, the Knesset, the one legislative body dominated by these separatist types and, you know, these right-wing, far-right-wing, and Netanyahu surrounded himself with racists and, you know, people who want to get rid of homosexuals. I mean, these really right-wing assholes that they have come up in the Knesset with a law they passed yesterday that
uh-huh.
said that the Supreme Court, this liberal Supreme Court that is checking, the only check and balance they have on this right-wing whack job stuff, they can no longer use the idea of reasonableness or unreasonableness to counteract or balance, you know, things that are done by the Knesset or the prime minister, which basically allows and, you know, endorses or accepts and allows all this, you know, basically ultimately the takeover of the West Bank by, you know, in other words, we own it all the way to the Jordan River, you know, and you people are simply, you know, basically you're dog shit citizens in Israel. And, you know, the one state solution where, you know, what do you do with Palestinians now? Because if we're a religious state and one of the people who benefit from this recent legislation or rule yesterday are the Orthodox Jews who don't have to serve in the military. You know, they're pure religious people,
right.
and they study religion all the time, and they don't have to serve in the military versus secularists who you know would want to. Okay, we have a society, we deal with all kinds of different people, and Palestinians are part of them. We could do better with them, and so this is another step in the road to pure autocratic rule, and of course. This is going to allow Benjamin Netanyahu to get away with his charges of corruption now in courts. And so, that's key.
Yeah.
His sorry little ass is going to be let off the hook because of this. I mean, this is just like Trump coming in, winning the presidency, so that he can pardon himself from six charges of felonies around the country. You know, I mean, this is super-duper corrupt, you know. And, you know, it bodes ill for Israel. I mean, we're talking now about, I mean, serious people, not just whack job leftists like me or you, talking about the $3.8 billion we pay this country every bloody year. What the hell, you know, they're a very rich country on their own. You know, and they're telling us to kiss their ass on a lot of things. You know, they're now cozying up to Saudi Arabia, where they murder New York Times columnists. And so, wait a goddamn minute here. Why are we sending people $3.8 million? Well, because a lot of Americans are Jews, I guess, you know. And I have had lunch with some of my Jewish friends, little guys, the other day, and we're all for, eliminate the $3.8 billion. They don't need it, you know. So it's, you know, a lot of American Jews are turning against Israel all of a sudden. So this is not over. This is only the plot thickens, you know. It's
They're turning it, I think, more. They don't like the faith of fundamentalist or orthodox religion represent a theocracy, becoming a theocracy, even though that's part of, I mean, that's sort of the existence of original after World War II was a, it's written out, but it's basically, you know, any Jew is offered dual citizenship.
Well, it's
now
out of the bag and it's overt. The United States has rubber stamped everything Israeli's done from the beginning, you know.
Right.
You know, we screwed over the Palestinians, so we rubber-stamped that whole thing.
We're
and so, and that's where we are. And now that rubber-stamping and sort of wink-wink, nod-nod isn't enough. Now they want it overtly written in the law that, Palestinians are goddamn losers, and we are the chosen people. Live with it, you shitbags. And that's what they're doing, you know. and Palestinians have to eat a lot of it, and you know, because the Saudis are pretty much blown off the Palestinians. They're more interested in money and the future and, you know, getting to be a powerful, wealthy, you know, company that runs the PGA golf tournaments and all this. And you know, they don't, well, we can live with the Palestinians being dog shit in Israel. That's fine. We'll be fine with that. And, you know, we'll have a wonderful society. We'll all be rich and, you know.
It's
disgusting, frankly, in my view.
it's white trash mentality,
it's
if you ask me. It's a mentality that probably every white trash person out here would probably go, well, I understand that.
It sounds reasonable to me.
Wrong.
The Supreme Court over there says it's unreasonable. Well, it sounds reasonable to me, you know. Back in the day, we used to know how to treat people like that, you know.
There we go. There we go with John Grant, listeners. John Grant. Thank you, John.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Mike. Yeah.
All right. We'll get some more movie talk in later next week on
Tuesday.
Yeah,
I've seen some pretty good ones. We'll talk next week. Yeah.
All right. Thanks. Yeah. There you go, listeners. Push it up, Tristan. Push it up. Thank you.
All right, guys. Take care.